You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, candy won, candy won. Many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by the Missouri AFL-CIO and the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 1464. The Missouri AFL-CIO represents working people across the state of Missouri and is their major voice in Jefferson City. IBEW, Local 1464, is a labor union that represents nearly 900 workers in Missouri and Kansas, primarily utility workers and in manufacturing. We strive to improve the lives of working people. When your power goes out, our members turn it back on. And we thank our underwriters for their support to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, we explore the conditions for child care workers and for Kansas teachers. Tune in to Rockabye Baby, The Wages is Crazy. And then we ask, why are Kansas teachers fleeing? We'll talk to a recent Kansas Teacher of the Year who left to teach in another state. In the news, California passes comparable worth bill, which will finally give women equal pay. And documents surface showing Walmart hired defense contractor Lockheed Martin and engaged the FBI to track workers who were organizing. Our feature at the end of the show is Safety First. And the headlines for that are Don Blankenship, guilty of conspiracy, whistleblower complaint successful for former hair salon employee, and House lawmakers grill OSHA administrator on enforcement issues. And now for the news.
News from our site, December 3rd, 2015. For years, women have been demanding equal pay, not just in name, but in fact. Congress has never responded, but on January 1st, the state of California, in response to pressure from unions and women, will enact the California Fair Pay Act. PAI reports that it will finally close loopholes created since the Federal Equal Pay Act passed in 1963. The law expands federal equal pay rights by mandating that employers pay workers, regardless of sex or gender, equally for substantially similar work, not just strictly equal work. What's substantially similar? A legal summary says employers must not pay workers of opposite sex less for substantially similar work when viewed as a composite of skill, effort, and responsibility. And the employer must take into account the similar working conditions, not just wages at the worksite or company branch involved. California employers could still discriminate in pay, but only if they can show the wage differences are due to seniority, merit, or a system that measures the quantity or quality of production, or a bona fide factor other than sex, such as education, training, or experience, the law adds. And if they cite those reasons, they must be directly job-related and show that the factor that produces wage discrimination is consistent with business necessity.
In a tactic reminiscent of the FBI's COINTELPRO program of the 1970s, Walmart management hired a top U.S. defense contractor, Lockheed Martin, and asked the FBI to spy on activist workers. The spying was contained in documents filed with the National Labor Relations Board in a case that Our Walmart, an employee group that lobbies management to improve pay and working conditions, filed with the agency. The Bloomberg Business Report disclosed the documents and Walmart's spying. The spying involved tracking approximately 100 activists, organizing a Black Friday protests in 2012 and 2013, and workers' subsequent demands for $15 hourly wage and the right to organize without company interference, harassment, repression, or retaliation. Mary Pat Tift, a Wisconsin Walmart employee, told a Common Dreams writer, quote, "We are fighting for all workers to be paid a fair wage and enough hours to put food on the table and provide for our families. To think that Walmart found us such a threat that they would hire a defense contractor and engage the FBI is a mind-blowing abuse of power," unquote. Tift wants elected officials, quote, "to launch an official investigation of the case." The documents, posted November 30th, show Walmart enlisting the defense contractor and the agency's Joint Terrorism Task Force to monitor worker activists. In those years, Walmart also illegally fired dozens of Our Walmart members for their activism and pro-worker stance. The documents show company executives first mobilized Walmart's emergency response team to battle Our Walmart and its mobilizing for a 2012 Black Friday national strike. Then it hired Lockheed Martin. When it heard that the Occupy Movement members might accompany Our Walmart activists to a demonstration during the firm's annual meeting at its Bentonville, Arkansas headquarters, it labeled them terrorists and asked the FBI's anti-terrorism task force to join. The documents do not detail the FBI's role, but sheesh.
Sheesh is right. Vietnam is already violating the unenforceable labor provisions in the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The Voice of America reports that a Vietnamese labor activist has accused authorities of beating and detaining her after she talked with fired workers in southern Long An province. Longtime labor rights advocate Do Thi Minh Han, once in prison for helping organize strikes, said she was held Monday for 13 hours without being given any reasons. Han, co-founder of the Free Viet Labor Federation, and another activist, Trong Minh Duc, said they came to give support and advice to dozens of workers who maintained that they had been unlawfully fired by a foreign-owned company. Brad Adams, Asia Director for Human Rights Watch, said last week that Vietnam appeared to play nice during the TPP negotiations, but now that the agreement has been signed, it's taking steps to tighten government control over critics. But on the other hand, Vietnam is raising its minimum wage. That's right. Late last month, the Wage Commission announced a 12.4% increase. That means the minimum will go up from $138 a month to $155.80. That's for Hanoi and Saigon, but other zones make less. That comes to $6.45 a day if you work 48 hours a week, which is common. The lowest zone in Vietnam makes $3.99 a day. So, with what the Obama administration calls strong labor provisions in the TPP, you have foreign-owned companies illegally firing workers who will be making less than $7 a day. Workers are harassed, arrested, and beaten if they try to do something to improve their lives. And TPP is being sold as a job creator here in the U.S. Of course, the fight over the TPP will heat up right after the first of the year.
In our last news, Mayor Sly James of Kansas City today fired back at Missouri Rep. Kurt Schaefer on his pre-filed bill for the 2016 legislative session. That bill would repeal the Kansas City and St. Louis earning taxes. Schaefer said he was doing it in retaliation for Kansas City's trying to raise the minimum wage. He claims that if Kansas City workers want a raise, the city could give it to them by eliminating the earnings tax. One of Schaefer's big donors is Moneybags Rex Singfeld, who several years ago financed a statewide initiative forcing the two cities to reauthorize the earning tax every 5 years. Today, Mayor James and the Kansas City Chamber of Commerce issued a joint press conference which said, "Civic and business leaders agree that the earning tax is a sound and fundamental way for Kansas City to finance city services." Tonight's news was read by Molly Madden, Jake White, Judy Ansel, and myself, Chris Mann.
To take a stand, not knowing I'd lose my best friend.
Stand.
But I'd rather live right than in hell. Lift up my eyes, all God's children just
stand.
Tell somebody, say,
you stand.
Get a Lord, yeah. Stand for holiness.
Stand for holiness.
Oh.
Stand for righteousness.
And be counted,
among them that shall reign with him.
Listeners, the title of our segment today is Rockabye Baby, The Wages is Crazy. Today we're going to have a discussion about two issues, a parent's perspective on balancing work and childcare when working in an environment with staggered hours and days. We will also have a discussion with a Head Start teacher to discuss various labor issues such as pay, lunch breaks, and how universal pre-K has affected the workers. Missouri is not a right-to-work state. Governor Jay Nixon vetoed the bill in June of this year. Therefore, child care workers can now organize and get a labor union. Historically, early learning and child care programs existed separately with separate goals. Early learning programs focus on preparing young children for school. In contrast, child care programs subsidized the cost of child care for low-income parents and infants, toddlers, and young children who were working or engaged in work-related activities or school. In 2013, President Obama introduced a new program called Universal Pre-K, which would merge early learning with child care programs. Today in the studio, we have a parent and also a Head Start teacher. They're both community advocates with Stand Up KC. The first guest is Latoya Caldwell, who works in the fast food industry. We also have with us today Kimberly DeVries, a Head Start teacher. Both Kimberly and Latoya are community activists, and they both work very actively in the community. They both also have been in the press a lot lately. Latoya has been in the New York Times, Kansas City Star, on MSNBC doing a documentary, and they both work for Fight for 15 with Stand Up KC. Latoya, can you tell us a little bit about Stand Up KC?
Yes, Stand Up KC started in New York with 200 fast food workers in November of 2012, and we have grown to 200 cities across the United States. Not only are we nationally, we're internationally now. Also, it's just not about fast food workers. Right. Adjunct professors, airport workers, childcare workers have also joined our fight now.
Oh, that's great. Now, Kimberly, can you tell us about Fight for 15?
We are working with workers all over the city and we're working with workers all over the city and country who are fast food workers, home healthcare workers, like Latoya just said, to try and raise our wages. The wages that we're currently making, we cannot survive on.
Okay. Latoya, can you describe for me an average day in your life as a fast food worker, juggling work and getting the kids to daycare?
I just recently had a baby in February of 2015 of this year, and it took me 6 months to get back to work due to not having child care assistance. You have to basically work a job first to get your first paycheck for the state to help you get child care assistance. So at that time, I was trying to pay people to take care of my children until I got my first paycheck to get them into daycare, and it took even 3 weeks after me starting my job to get child care, which means some days I couldn't go to work because I had no one to watch my children, or having to leave work early due to somebody having to do something else and not being able to take care of my kids.
Okay, now, are you full-time as a fast food worker with benefits?
I'm a full-time shift lead at Wendy's, and so the benefits that I have is still not enough to take care of my children and also pay child care fees.
Okay, well, now, do you have extra benefits if the child is sick, you know, according to the Family Leave Act? Do they do that at Wendy's?
No.
No.
So okay. That means that they pay. I won't be able to get. Recently, my daughter, she's 4 years old. She attends daycare, and she just got a double ear infection, so she was unable to go to daycare for 48 hours. So I had to take 2 days off work because I wasn't able to take her to daycare.
And that's work without pay.
Yes, work without
pay. Okay. Now, as a fast food worker, you work various hours. How is it getting child care? Do you have to juggle your
hours? I have to pick and choose. Weekends are hard because I have no child care on the weekends, so weekends are hard trying to find somebody to watch the children. Right now, the daycare is set up from 9:30 to 6 p.m., and some days I have to be at work at 9 a.m. And with me dropping them off at daycare at 9 a.m., I have to pick them up by 5. And sometimes I don't get off work till 7 or 8 o'clock. So I have to depend on somebody to pick up my children from the daycare facility.
Right. And, you know, a lot of workers no longer have cookie cutter hours.
No.
And so you have a conflict, a scheduling conflict with your care providers. Mm-hmm. Now I have a question for you. What percentage of your income do you feel that you spend on child care?
Child care, I have a sliding fee. My sliding fee every 2 weeks is $150 every 2 weeks.
Okay, that's good. Okay. Okay. Now, if you look at child care workers as surrogate parents, do you expect them to reflect your views and also to be on the same moral compass with you?
Yes, I do.
You do?
They take care of our precious jewels. And
that's right.
They need more benefits and a better pay to take care of our children because they teach them things that we don't have time for because we're working full time.
Okay. Kimberly, do you want to add something to that as a child care worker?
I mean, as child care workers, we definitely work with parents and try and, you know, team up with them and be in relationship to help them with raising their children. I love these children that I teach very much, and while they're at school, I love them like they're my own.
Okay, now you're a teacher at Head Start. Mm-hmm. Now, are you a professional teacher or teacher's assistant?
I'm a teacher assistant.
Okay, I was wondering, according to the Fair Labor Standards Act, when they talk about overtime and minimum wage requirements, it says here, and I pulled this from the government's website, to qualify as a teacher professional, your main responsibilities need to involve instructing children in some way, such as tutoring them or lecturing them. Do you ever have to switch roles and do that in your job, or are you just in a nurturing position?
Well, at Head Start, we definitely do education focused, but it doesn't look like what you think of school for, you know, primary age children. Mm-hmm. A lot of what learning happens is through play, and so you know, a lot of activities are we do things like having them work with building blocks, and that helps them learn different skills, or they get to play in the house area and they explore different roles in the community. They get to start learning about science when they're dumping and filling baskets. They're learning about space and volume. So our teaching doesn't look like this is how we add, because my kids are 18 months old right now.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay,
it's a little bit different than even preschool or kindergarten.
Okay. Now, I know the child care workers want to organize and have a union. What sort of things do you think you need for a union? Is it your hours or your pay?
I mean, at my work, things are pretty good, except that we don't get paid well enough to be able to meet all of our financial obligations. But there are a lot of child care workers that have less benefits than I do. And so we are definitely looking for paid sick time, for vacation days that are paid. Child care workers are looking for a living wage, at least $15 an hour, because we cannot survive on our wages. I make $10.32 an hour, and it's really hard for me to do things like get an x-ray for my knee that hurts, and it affects my ability to work. At $10.32 an hour, it's hard for me to pay back my $90,000 in student loans. So we definitely need to get $15 an hour, and having a union gives us strength in numbers to organize.
Okay, are you aware that the living wage in Missouri is $15.71? And that's just for you to be able to live without any government subsidies?
And if you have children, it's even higher.
It is even higher.
It's $21 for a single person and a child. So, yeah, $15 an hour is a starting point.
Right. You know, children are our most precious possessions, and for us to be paying child care workers, you know, a mere $10.32, and I'm sure you worked up to the $10.32.
Yes, I did.
And, you know, what does that say about how we value our most precious possessions? LaToya, how do you feel about her wages? You're on the parent side. She's on the worker's side.
I stand with all workers. We live in a rich country that we should be able to be paid $15 and no less. It's a shame that we're paid $10.32 or $10 an hour to do the job that we do. We go to work every day, but we go home to no lights. We go home to no water. We go home to an eviction notice. And they take care of our precious jewels. They take care of our babies. And they teach them things that we're unable to teach because we're at work or we have other obligations to do. And they're basically raising our children throughout the day while we're at work, doing right. The things that we can't do for our own children. And it's a shame that they only get paid $10.32.
Right. And, you know, the child care workers are with our children more than we are as parents. And we need to put a higher value on the workers. For our listening audience who may have just chimed in, today's topic is Rockabye Baby, The Wages is Crazy. In the studio, we have a parent, LaToya Caldwell, and a Head Start teacher, Kimberly DeVries, and they're both community activists with Stand Up KC. LaToya, now let's say Kimberly. Kimberly, can you tell me what would be the advantages and disadvantages to having a union represent child care workers?
Having a union would definitely give us the ability to organize. What a lot of us know is that we're not making enough money to survive, and by having a union, we would be able to organize and raise our wages. And for child care workers that don't get things like sick time and like paid sick time, paid days off, it would help workers be able to get better working conditions.
For our listeners, Kimberly works at Head Start, and she's also in an early Head Start program, and it's a child care program federally funded by the government and is open to low-income families. And the Head Start program provides educational activities and care for children, as well as parent educational courses for pregnant women and families. You know, the starting pay for child care workers in Missouri, is that minimum wage, Kimberly?
I'm not sure. I do know that there are child care workers that make much less than I do.
Okay. I want to thank our guests today, LaToya Caldwell and Kimberly DeVries, for their perspectives and keen insight on these subjects. The plight of the fast food worker parents juggling schedules and daycare, and also the fight for child care workers organizing and fighting to have themselves unionized. to have representation for negotiating salaries, lunch breaks, and various policies that affect them. Now, LaToya, we're going to wrap this up, but do you have some closing words, things you want the listeners to hear?
We're calling on our elected officials to know that we stand with child care workers, that in this coming up election year 2016, that if you don't stand with child care workers, fast food workers, or any workers that are trying to get 15 in the union, you won't have our vote.
Okay, Kimberly, some parting words?
I'd just like to echo what LaToya said. I vote every election, and I'm paying attention to what you stand for. So come get our vote and fight for $15 an hour in union rights.
Okay, thank you, Kimberly. I mentioned earlier about Universal Pre-K, and this is a program that President Obama brought to the public in 2013. And Universal Pre-K, the idea is pretty simple. American children are guaranteed an education when they turn 5 and enter kindergarten. Before that, they may or may not have access to what we now call preschool, which typically depends on the resources of their parents. More affluent families tend to get their kids into decent daycares and nursery schools. Less affluent families do not. I do believe with the implementation of universal pre-K, that should prompt our elected officials to, pursue a higher wage for our workers. Research suggests that the first few years, and particularly the first 2 years, are critical for the development of intellectual behavior skills. Mm-hmm. And providing low-income kids access to decent, affordable preschool can help make up for what they're not getting already. Can you speak on that, Kimberly?
Yeah, research shows that early childhood education is crucial. It can affect life far into their future. It can prevent teenage pregnancy. It can lower rates of children going to prison when they're like adults. It helps them have a better start in their life. As somebody who's worked in schools with older children, I could always tell the students who had gone to preschool because they had learned more skills about how to interact with their peers and how to be students, and they had more knowledge on their ABCs and some early writing. And so quality, affordable childcare is very important. It gives the teachers the ability to not also be in the throes of poverty, which makes it hard when teachers are stuck at work worrying about if their lights are going to be on or off. It's really hard to be a good teacher when you need an x-ray but you can't afford to get one to figure out what's wrong with your knee. And so paying childcare workers better helps to have better education, which is what's so crucial for these young children's future.
Okay, so it sounds like a win-win situation for everyone. LaToya, would you like to speak to that?
I think it's very crucial for children to go to early pre-K because I have a 4-year-old that when we first started daycare, she didn't know how to interact with other children. She had never been around any other children. And just the skills that she had got from going to early childhood school is helpful now that she has now a little brother. She's able to interact with him like she's supposed to. She knows how to make friends. She knows how to write her name now, tie her shoes.
Great.
So things that I wasn't able to teach her, the child care worker has taught her. So they need to raise the wage for child care workers also.
Is there anything else you'd like to add to? Did I miss everything, miss anything here? Is there anything else you would like to add?
We just hope that we have Kansas City's support for raising the wage and getting union rights for all workers.
Absolutely. Okay. My name is Shaiklin Hams, and I want to thank you for listening to this segment of Rockabye Baby, The Wages is Crazy.
Dismantling Patriarchy on Wings, Saturday afternoon at 2:30.
Democracy Now! Broadcasts live from the UN Climate Summit every weekday from 8 to 9 a.m. through December 11th, right here on KKFI.
You know, everybody loves your neighborhood teacher, but no one wants to pony up to pay us a salary where we can survive. Well, if teaching were easy, we wouldn't have a shortage, right?
It is a symptom of the sick and fractured system of education.
I think I always had it in me to become a teacher, but I never wanted teacher pay.
We're underfunded, we have less resources, we're kind of expected to give up of our time. We're expected to go the extra mile all the time without being asked even if I can.
You know, I think that it's as important to guide students through an education as it is to help someone in the hospital who's sick or uphold the law in a courtroom.
There is a certain amount of demonization of teachers that goes on, knowing how hard we work and knowing what's actually happening in a classroom. It's hard to hear people put down your profession.
In somebody's class is the next bioscientist. In somebody's class is the next discoverer. It's so important that we renegotiate what we think about teachers.
I would say on a national level, it's too much politics involved in public education. There's too much money tied to policies and ideas about what education should be and how education should happen. There's not a lot of actual educators in that conversation, which I find extremely problematic.
If you look at the education system, the highest need students usually have the lowest, smallest amount of resources.
It is difficult, especially when you teach in communities of color or low-income communities. They bring a lot of trauma into the room.
If you have students arriving every day and their minds are elsewhere, they don't know where they're going to sleep at night, they're cold, they're hungry, their stomachs are growling. Across the board, generally, like, they're not going to thrive.
I think when you talk to teachers, the thing that we're most frustrated with in regards to our kids is the amount of testing that they have to go through.
We are testing children to death, and we're testing teachers to death. 20 years ago, we might have spent as much as 2 weeks testing. Today, in 2015, the average number of weeks a child spends taking tests can be up to 6 weeks.
And it just seems like a reoccurring thing. It's just happening over and over again. Let's try a new test. Let's try new standards. Let's mandate them. Let's see what happens.
We've been putting band-aids and we've been trying to backtrack and replace parts. Why don't we look at a way to create a more holistic education, which includes social, emotional content and curriculum?
The best part? Where do I begin?
Oh, the kids, right? The students, the young adults. They're the best part of the job.
I wouldn't give it up for the world. It's the best choice I ever made was to be an eighth grade English teacher.
For every teacher, it's when you see that spark, when you see a student engage, they're doing something that they love and they're good at it and they feel confident. They feel like they found their place in the world. That's my favorite part.
The teacher I worked for kind of mentored me. I know he thought that I could be a good teacher, but you know, he was wrong. I'm not a good teacher, I'm a great teacher.
The person sitting in that room is teaching to our future, is teaching to the hope of a nation, is teaching to the potential of a world. Might we value that more as a society? Might we value that more?
Welcome to the second half of the Heartland Labor Forum. My name is Chris Mann, and I will be hosting this segment of the program. The introduction you've just heard was Teachers Say What's Wrong About Education in the United States. This was taken from the news channel AJ Plus. AJ Plus is an internet news community that highlights human struggles and achievements, empowers impassioned voices, and challenges the status quo. Tonight we're exploring the topic, Why Are Teachers Fleeing from Kansas? We have as our guest Camden Hanslick Burton. Mr. Burton wrote a letter to the Kansas City Star that was published on October 13th in the As I See It column. Mr. Hanslick Burton outlined his reasoning for teachers legitimately wanting to seek employment away from Kansas, not Kansas City, but the state of Kansas. We are pleased to have Camden with us tonight. The exodus has been caused by years of budget cuts, the elimination of due process rights, and attempts to criminalize the distribution of harmful material, in quotations, under a state public morals statute. This resulted in a Missouri school district placing billboards on the Kansas Turnpike advertising for teachers to work in Independence, Missouri. We're delighted to have Camden here to tell us why he wrote the letter and what are the implications for public education in Kansas. Tell our listeners a little bit about yourself. Why did you want to be a teacher in the first place? And what's it like to be Teacher of the Year?
My freshman year of college, I began in an introductory biology course. And I realized during that time that I was encouraged to consider science as a profession. And that started when I was in high school by my teacher that I had there. And that actually triggered me to think that I could maybe be that person for somebody else. And that's what triggered me to actually go take an education class in college and consider teaching as a career. As far as being Biology Teacher of the Year, it is very humbling to get that award, and it is a culmination of something that teachers are very familiar with, which is it's a lot to do with collaboration between teachers at my school, organizations like the program I graduated from at KU, the You Can Teach program, national organizations like the Fellowship that I'm part of with the Null Science Teaching Foundation. It's a community effort.
A colleague at my school read your letter that you wrote to the Kansas City Star. Why did you feel so strongly to write a letter to the Star? And the letter outlined why you were not going to be a teacher in Kansas anymore.
Being a teacher, a new teacher within their first 5 years, while there wasn't a specific person necessarily adding pressure to me, it felt like it maybe wouldn't be a wise career move to speak out against some of the things going on, specifically since I was a state employee as a public educator. But once I moved, I felt with the award and not being in the state, I sort of had this platform and a chance to provide the voice of a teacher, to provide, you know, the reasons that I laid out in the article, specifically going after, you know, things that have already been said, but maybe not necessarily by a teacher, that governor and our legislator, people who supported him, were, you know, legislating from behind a desk, people who have never been teachers in their life, and were not necessarily making the job as a teacher any easier.
Okay, and what are some of the current conditions for working teachers in Kansas?
Certainly what's gotten maybe the most attention is the removal of due process for teachers in Kansas. So, you know, commonly people would say after the first three years of teaching in the same district that you would be granted what people called tenure. You had the right to be guaranteed a reason for why you would be terminated. And that was removed under what I would say is the logic of the governor saying, oh, this is to get rid of the bad teachers. Good teachers, you have nothing to worry about. But in reality, it follows this common theme of distrust of teachers in the profession. Not trusting that we're going to do our job correctly as professionals. So finding a way to be able to get rid of them when they felt like that was best fit.
Okay, and what are the conditions facing Kansas teachers that directly impact the students that are adverse?
So one thing I do want to make a point is that teachers will have always been there and will always be there, and they travel throughout different governors, legislators, all sorts of climates. And what I'd like to think is that they've certainly thrown up barriers to educators, but they take it and they run with it just like always. They're going to get their students and they're going to have them learn in despite of even with what's going on. I would say that some of the negative things that have come out are generally probably affecting the teachers' day-to-day lives. Maybe their job security, or they feel uncomfortable or maybe even unsafe with what is being decided. When it comes to students, I don't know if I would necessarily say that. I think teachers do a good job of being the professionals they are and continuing with their day.
Yes, and I guess the atmosphere does change when you're always worried about your job.
It does.
So that will be transmitted to the students.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And how has education changed since you've become a teacher? Are the changes positive or negative?
When I started teaching, we were in our teacher prep program. We learned about Common Core. And I came in the first year where Common Core was being put into the schools. And with that, I think some of the fundamental differences I started to see where there is a very real concern with over-testing, students being given standardized tests too often. And what actually I think is more to their detriment is maybe some of the culture that's created because of like things like No Child Left Behind, which came from a positive place of creating accountability, led to a place of over-testing and teaching to tests. And that's not what teachers know works today. And they knew that before, and they knew it during. But what I think things that have come from that, if we can standardize tests on their own or not, should not be demonized. They are good measures for how students are learning. But if we can think about things like Common Core, which are starting to put more emphasis on student skills and practices, rather than things like regurgitation of facts or memorization. Those are the things that I think are the actual positive changes coming around. And that's what we've always known is good for students, to provide them learning experiences that are focused on skills that they will use outside of high school or outside of whatever schooling system they are in. Things and giving them experiences like community-based education, project-based learning, inquiry-based learning. These are the things that we know have for a long time are good practices, and this is what I think is starting to be encouraged and what I hope is what we're moving towards, even with our standardized tests.
Yes, and some school districts have also gone to a portfolio type of assessment, which is an all-round view of the students.
Yeah, so. Students proving their own learning, similar mm-hmm. to, not different than what you would see an artist do, mm-hmm. is certainly a great way for students to show their learning.
So what are the positive changes that need to take place, do you think, to help recruit, maintain, retain excellent public school teachers?
I really think sort of the way you framed it is that it really does start with the teachers and it ends with the teachers. Recruiting those teachers, recruiting people who are passionate about their subject area, whatever that may be, and asking them in college or wherever it is, even as a new career choice, to give teaching a chance, but using it not following the old those who can do and those who can't teach. We're going away from that. Those who are truly passionate, who have an interest in preparing what is the society, the future society of America, those are the people we want to become educators. And while education is maybe attacked by people, the legislation of Kansas, I do think that we are focusing on the right place, which is our teachers and teacher prep programs and professional development, encouraging teachers to talk to each other, to collaborate with each other. Teaching cannot be done in a vacuum. It obviously is affected by the climate around it, but when teachers come together, really great things happen, and we need to gain the respect back. Specifically, we're not getting that respect from our government, and just like doctors and lawyers and engineers, these people have incredible professional communities. Teachers do as well. And there's a lot to be gained from participating as a community of teachers that can create change, both going up through administrations, through districts, through state government, but also where it all matters. It affects our students. We're the ones who take all that's given us, and we're the ones who translate that for our student.
And why do you think the respect is not there? The job is certainly difficult.
You know, that I think there are there's a long history of societal implications of who traditionally were teachers, what value a teacher had, what we thought in education. For a long time, education was not for everybody. For a long time, teachers were not necessarily these people who were coming from the workforce, who were coming from this great depth of knowledge about these subjects. And I think some of that still is left today. Teachers maybe don't have the voice to be standing outside or standing within the Capitol and making these decisions. But certainly this, you know, like I mentioned before, they are preparing the next crop of our workforce and our citizens. And I don't know if you can find a profession that does that like education does.
So if teaching does not become, in the eyes of the public, a desired occupation, what's at stake for our society as a whole, for public education? Because it surely holds a place, it's kind of the glue that holds our democracy together. So
it absolutely is. If it is shooting yourself in the foot, if you don't invest in your future, I don't think you should be surprised 10 years down the road what you find out. And I think that's typically due to some short-sightedness of what's truly at stake when education is not valued above practically anything else. All the problems we'll see can come back to that. You can break the cycle by investing in education, investing in teachers and teacher prep programs and fostering teacher communities. But I think that's where it needs to start. It's going to start with teachers, and it's going to start with the trust that we have in them, that they're doing what's best for students, and they do what's best for students, unfortunately, sometimes in environments that are doing their best to not help them. But a teacher will always be there. And I think that's where we start refocusing our efforts. If you ever take time to talk to a teacher, you will hear these stories and you can't believe that they will walk into that school the next day. And yet they keep doing it. They're incredibly passionate. And when they talk to each other, incredible things do happen. And I think this all happens regardless of what's going on. So if we were to just give them more of that respect, show them that respect through encouraging many people to take teaching seriously as a profession, to elevate it to the status of being a doctor, of being a lawyer, of being an engineer, and also then investing in, once they've chosen that profession, to allow them to continue their work, to communicate with other people outside of their schools and to take an active role in their leadership at their schools or wherever they feel that they can be a leader. That makes a happy teacher, and a happy and healthy teacher is going to, of course, make happy and very healthy students.
So we're about out of time, and we really appreciate you coming, Camden. However, I just wondered if you had any message for your fellow Kansas teachers.
There's a small part of me that really did hurt when I left Kansas. Certainly there was a piece that felt like I was giving up on these other people who are still there, and they still teach these students who I still feel very passionate about. And I was born a Kansan. I will always be a Kansan, and I take great pride in that. And I want to continue to emphasize that they're doing their best, and what they do is great. They're making a difference every day, and that in spite of what is going on around them and all the things that all the issues that they might face, the importance, of course, is always the students, and they know that, and they will continue to do their best job. And I hope that what I say can only encourage them and hope to make change that makes their teaching lives better and not in any way affect them otherwise.
Well, thank you again for taking the time, and we wish you lots of luck in the school year, and thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
And thank you for listening tonight. We especially want to thank Camden Hanslick-Burton for being our guest and for starting a discussion in the Kansas community about the direction and purpose for public education. I wanted to end by a quote from John Kuhn, who is the superintendent of the Perrin Witt Public School District in Texas. He says, "I just kind of accepted whatever rolled down from Washington, D.C., and whatever rolled down from Austin. I just kind of thought the role of a teacher and an educator was just to live with dumb policies. And I don't think that anymore. I think now that I have a moral obligation to speak up and say, hey, this policy is dumb. It doesn't work. And this is what we're seeing in the front lines." Thanks again to John Kuhn, Camden Hanslick-Burton, for speaking up. Good night, and thank you for listening.
Working at this job is dirty and dangerous, and I'm taking risks anyway. Oh, if I had the time and the proper equipment, I could do my job safely each day. Everybody here says they're sticklers for safety, and I'm not here to say that they lie. I'm saying we just come to work here.
Hello, this is Mary Ario for Safety First. First, Don Blankenship, guilty of conspiracy, from www.wvgazettemail.com for December 3rd. In April 2010, an explosion rocked the Upper Big Branch coal mine in southern West Virginia, killing 29 miners. A federal jury on Thursday, December 3rd, found former Massey Energy CEO Don Blankenship guilty of conspiring to willfully violate mine safety standards. Don Blankenship is the first CEO of a major corporation to face criminal prosecution over workplace safety issues. The jury found him not guilty of securities fraud and not guilty of making false statements in the wake of the Upper Big Branch mine disaster. The count Blankenship was convicted of conspiring is a misdemeanor for which he could face up to 1 year in prison. His sentencing has tentatively been set for March 23, 2016. U.S. Attorney Booth Goodwin at a news conference shortly after the verdict said this is a landmark day for the safety of coal miners. If you violate the laws and gamble with the lives of your workers, you will be held accountable. An appeal is expected. Next, whistleblower complaint successful for former hair salon employee, from www.osha.gov news release for December 1st. A receptionist fired illegally at a Bronx hair salon in June 2012 for telling her colleagues about the hazards of a formaldehyde-containing straightener the salon used will be compensated for unlawful retaliation, according to a federal consent judgment. The judgment ordered the defendants to pay the former employee $65,000 in lost wages and $100,000 in compensatory damages for pain and suffering. It also requires Salon Zoe to expunge the employee's personnel records of all references to this matter and her termination, and upon request, provide a written neutral job reference. A whistleblower investigation by the Department of Labor's Occupational Safety and Health Administration found Salon Zoe and its owner illegally discharged the receptionist days after she gave her colleagues an OSHA fact sheet about formaldehyde hazards. The department filed a lawsuit in the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York in February 2015 after attempts to settle the matter voluntarily did not succeed. Here's a simple message here. Don't fire, discriminate, or retaliate against your employees when they raise legitimate health and safety issues. There will be consequences, said Jeffrey S. Rogoff, the regional solicitor of labor in New York. OSHA enforces the whistleblower provisions of the Occupational Safety and Health Act and 21 other statutes protecting employees who report violations of various consumer product, environmental, food safety, worker safety, and other laws. Detailed information on employee whistleblower rights, including fact sheets, is available at whistleblowers.gov. Finally, House lawmakers grill OSHA administrator on enforcement issues, from the National Law Review at www.natlawreview.com for December 2nd. At a House subcommittee hearing on October 7th, the head of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, Dr. David Michaels, faced a grilling from Republican lawmakers over recently issued guidance memoranda for agency inspectors and examples of allegedly over-the-top enforcement actions. Two lawmakers who were not members of the subcommittee peppered Michaels with examples of allegedly unreasonable OSHA enforcement. Contending that enforcement should be coupled with common sense, Representative Vicki Hartzler, Republican Missouri, gave examples of employers who she said were cited, for example, because water at an eyewash station was too cold. Representative Mike Rogers, Republican Alabama, called attention to an employer who allegedly got a $50,000 penalty for not having a yellow line around a machine. Michael said he would have to look at the specifics of these complaints. Safety First looked into the specifics of these complaints. First, the $50,000 OSHA fine was likely for a company called C. Haesung Alabama Inc., now a major employer in Andalusia, who makes parts for Hyundai and Kia. The company was cited in December 2014 for exposing workers to crush, by and amputation hazards by not providing guarding protection for a number of hazardous machines, and these were repeat violations. Too bad if Representative Rogers does not regard correcting these hazards as important. Cold eyewash water, less than 60 degrees Fahrenheit, can inhibit workers from fully flushing out toxic or corrosive chemicals. I hope that Representative Hartzler uses her eyes to see the importance of this requirement. This is Mary Ariel for Safety First.
Heartland Labor Forum Calendar, November 26, 2015. Kansas City Jobs with Justice 7th Annual Scrooge Holiday Party with an Attitude. Thursday, December 10th, 5 to 7 p.m. at IBEW Local Union 124 Hall. For more information, call KC Jobs with Justice at 816-805-2385.
And I'll give you some more information about Scrooge because I'm going. I hope you're going, Ariana. It's a really fun party. It's for a great cause. And there are, I think, four candidates for Scrooge this year. You can go on the Missouri Jobs with Justice webpage in order to find them. And we sell votes, $1 a vote, and all of it goes to benefit Jobs with Justice. And it's a party that has games and lots of good food and all sorts of stuff. So I really encourage people to show up. Also, you can find our calendar and our future shows and our past archived shows on our webpage, which is at heartlandlaborforum.org. Tune in next week to the show. We're going to have David K. Johnson on. He's going to be talking about ensuring prosperity and companies that offshore what ought to be in our tax coffers. And then we're going to be asking, why are Canadian unions stronger than us? Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zaman.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.